much we love him back by offering him success or accomplishments or status or titles. Here's the problem. These are just a bunch of tickets that mean nothing to him. He wants our hearts, not our help. That same awkward website also said we were serving the poorest of the poor. It sounded like I was stepping over poor people and calling them posers while searching for the poorest of the poor so we could help them instead. My insecurity had me sounding like it was nobler to help the poorest of the poor than just the merely poor. I'm sure heaven grimaces every time I do things like this. What I had done is to make it about me yet again, and our lives will never be about Jesus if we keep making everything about ourselves. If we're going to change, we need to take some of the familiar words describing what we're doing and trade those words in for the ones Jesus used. For instance, I'm usually serving people right up until I tell everyone about how I'm serving everybody. When I do, I make it about me. We don't need to go on missions trips any longer. Jesus' friends never called them this. They knew love already had a name. I've known some remarkable and courageous missionaries. Perhaps you have too. But for many, when they think of missionaries, they think of Spaniards with chest armor, a galleon, and the flu, and then all the indigenous people die. Instead of saying you're a missionary, why not just go to somewhere and learn about your faith from the people you find there and be as helpful as you can be? The neat part is most of the people I know who go on missions trips are already doing exactly that. We don't need to call everything we do ministry anymore either. Just call it Tuesday. That's what people who are becoming love do. Saving a whole generation, the poorest of the poor, serving, missionaries, ministry. Before I started getting pickier about what I was saying, I made everything all about me. Yet Jesus's message to the world is as simple as it is challenging. It's not about us anymore. It's about him. There's nothing wrong with matching shirts and wristbands. We just don't need them anymore. People who are turning into love don't need all the spin because they aren't looking for applause or validation from others any longer. They've experienced giving away God's love as its own reward. They also don't need to write Jesus as the return address of every loving thing they've ever done. They also don't need to write Jesus as the return address of every loving thing they've done. People who are turning into love give their love away freely without any thought about who gets credit for it. Jesus doesn't need credit, and we shouldn't either. When the heavens themselves declare his glory, he doesn't need our endorsement. Some people will tell you how many times they've talked about Jesus to someone during the day as if they're keeping count. I'm not really sure why. If I kept track of the times I mentioned Sweet Maria the way some people do about Jesus, she would think I was nuts. I can't imagine coming home and saying, "Honey, I mentioned your name 5 times today, once by the water cooler and another time to someone who was going through a really hard time, and 3 times on a corner to people I didn't know." She'd probably pause graciously for a minute, check my pupils and see if I was on drugs, and then sadly ask me, "You're counting?" Keeping track of how many times I'd mentioned Sweet Maria wouldn't be evidence of a terrific marriage. It would be evidence of a whacked relationship. What if we simply talk about the things we love? People do that with sports and cars and music and food. None of them keep track of how many times they talk about these things. We talk about what we love the most. People who are becoming love talk a lot more about what God's doing than what they're doing because they've stopped keeping score. The next time you're tempted to boast, just say under your breath, "It's not about me." Say it 12 times a day. Say it 1,000 times a month. Say it when you wake up in the morning and when you go to sleep. Say it again and again. "It's not about me. It's not about me." Say it when you bless a meal or do something wonderful or selfless or when you help hurting people. Make it your anthem and your prayer. When we keep track of the good we've done or love people with an agenda, it's no longer love. It's just a bunch of tickets. We can either keep track of all the good we've done or all the good God's done. Only one will really matter to us. In the end, none of us wants to find out we've traded the big life Jesus talked about for a box full of worthless acknowledgement. One of the challenges I've had in not keeping track of everything I've done for Jesus is that I remember everything. I don't try to, I just do. I feel like Rain Man. I remember every kind thing I've ever done for anyone. There's a bigger problem. I remember everyone who's ever wronged me or done something I thought was unfair. I'm a lawyer. I guess it just comes with the turf. I've taken and passed the bar exam in 3 states on the first try. For one of them, I only studied for a week and a half before taking it. The reason? I can memorize things. And that's gotten in the way of me becoming love. Because people who turn into love don't keep track anymore. They don't memorize the good or bad they or anyone else have done. They memorize grace instead. Jesus didn't do any of the relational math either. He just became love, and the world's never been the same. The promise of love and grace in our lives is this. Our worst day isn't bad enough, and our best day isn't good enough. We're invited because we're loved, not because we earned it. Chapter 10. From the Lighthouse Window. Everyone hits a couple of wrong notes. My parents made me take piano lessons when I was young. It wasn't a discussion. They said it would be good for me, kind of like spinach for my fingers. Once a week, an ancient woman in a pastel cardigan would sit next to me at the piano with perfect posture, looking over my shoulder as I fumbled over the keys. She always seemed to be wearing a frown, as if it was tattooed on her face. Every sour note was made worse by her scowls, grimaces, and disapproving grunts. Sometimes I would miss notes on purpose, just to see her wrinkled face fold up like origami. After 6 months of practicing, it was time for my first recital. There would be two of us playing that night, Greg and me. Greg went to my elementary school and had the same stuffy piano teacher I had. We were going to play the same tune. Even though I had been practicing for much longer, I knew he'd end up playing the song better. Greg was the kind of kid who was good at everything. He was the most talented and confident guy at the elementary school and somehow commanded a room when he entered it. He played sports, did math, gave speeches, traded corn futures, rebuilt engines, and he was only 9. Greg arrived at the recital in a tux with monogrammed sleeves and a creased handkerchief in his pocket. He sat up straight at the piano, flipped his tails behind him, and elegantly played a song called From the Lighthouse Window. He played so flawlessly, I thought he must be the magical offspring of Beethoven and Elton John. His fingers were perfectly curled like an American bald eagle. He even crossed his hands over each other as he played, like they do in the movies. As he hit the last chord, he lifted both clawed hands over his head. He stayed in that pose for an oddly long time as the room exploded in applause. Greatness had just arrived on Earth. It was Greg. It was my turn next. I walked on stage in checkered pants and an itchy sweater my mom bought for me. I looked like Mr. Rogers. I glanced up at the audience members who were leaning forward with great anticipation after Greg's epic performance. Then I looked down at the keys. There were so many of them. I didn't remember whether I was supposed to start on the black ones or the white ones, so I started on both and fumbled my way through the song. It was truly awful. There was no lighthouse. There was no window. My rendition was full of mistakes, awkward pauses, and do-overs. It took me twice as long to finish the song as it had taken Greg. Instead of finishing with clawed fingers over my head, I plunked my forehead on the keys, my arms hanging limp, and I sobbed. I was so ashamed. Charlie Brown couldn't have looked more pitiful. A few people clapped to break the awkward silence as I walked off stage with my head hung low. I was humiliated. That was the day I quit playing piano. Years later, in college, I lived in a dorm across from the music building. There was a big auditorium and a black grand piano on the stage. I passed by the auditorium several times each day on my way to and from classes. Sometimes I'd peek inside to see if anybody was playing the grand piano, but nobody ever was. Seeing the piano brought back painful memories of my embarrassing recital from so many years before. To me, it looked like a hearse with white and black keys. It reminded me of the day that I failed in front of everyone. One day, for no particular reason, I pushed open the door to the auditorium, walked down the aisle between hundreds of empty red velvet seats, got on the stage, and sat at the piano. I didn't have on checkered pants or a cardigan sweater, but I immediately felt like I was that same kid, scared to start playing again and terrified I'd stop if I did. Nevertheless, I decided I'd make another run at From the Lighthouse Window. I sat up straight, curled my fingers like Greg had, and started playing. And you know what? I nailed it. I hit every note perfectly. If it were the Olympics, there would have been confetti everywhere and people would have been lighting torches, doing flips off bars, and spiking themselves into the mats while judges held up double-digit numbers. I bet a picture of me sitting at a huge piano probably would have ended up on a box of cereal. It had been more than 10 years since my fateful piano recital. I had no sheet music. I hadn't even thought about From the Lighthouse Window or played a piano in as long. Yet still, I played it flawlessly. Finishing the last few stanzas, I pounded out my last chord, bringing both of my hands crashing down on the keys like I was a Viking. My fingers landed with undeniable power and authority and passion. Slowly, I lifted my clawed fingers over my head and then held them there for a really long time. I wondered, how could this be? Simple. No audience, no spotlights, and a lot of finger memory. The difference between great improvisational jazz and great classical recitals is simply, in the first, there are no wrong notes. If someone makes a mistake, nobody cares or even notices. Everyone just keeps tapping their feet. In recitals, everyone expects perfection. We spend a lot of time doing recitals in our faith communities than I think Jesus had in mind. Stages, audiences, and platforms change us. People who are becoming loved don't need any of it. It's not inherently bad to have all the stages, but we can end up playing to the wrong audience. My friends and I have been trying a live event experience called Living Room. It's a place that doesn't have any stages. We had the first one in our home in San Diego, and we didn't give any details. We didn't tell anybody who was going to be there, who was going to speak, who would play music, or what we were going to do if they came. We just said everybody was invited. This is the way Jesus did it. After Jesus went to heaven, his friends invited everyone to their living rooms too. They broke bread together and had things in common. That's what we were aiming for. Even though I'm very outgoing and public, Sweet Maria and I are pretty private people. So the idea of inviting strangers into our house was a little unsettling, particularly for Sweet Maria, who is more introverted. We had no idea whether someone would come out of our bedroom wearing my boxers and carrying her umbrella. We set the day and time to sign up, and we said we could fit about 30 people in our living room, but we could squeeze 60 in. When the time came, more than 800 people signed up in 4 minutes. The ones we could fit in came over, and we had a terrific time together. For the rest, we rented the House of Blues next to Disneyland a short time later. I called a few more friends to come and speak and play music. Then we handed out tickets to Disneyland, where we did our breakout sessions. The people who wanted to talk about their future met one of the speakers in Tomorrowland. The ones who wanted to talk about their biggest fears met at the Haunted Mansion. A friend of mine who works with the homeless was on Main Street. Another who was a rapper was at Cinderella's Castle. I, of course, was at Tom Sawyer Island. I was reminded, where we meet matters as much as what we say, maybe even more. Some of the best conversations we could be having are happening in the wrong places. We had another event to bring people together. We didn't pick the most popular city in the country. We picked one of the least popular ones. It reminded us about how God didn't pick Jerusalem. He picked relatively unappreciated places like Bethlehem and Nazareth to gather people. I put up our house as collateral and we rented the convention center. An amazing group of musicians and speakers agreed to come for little more than pizza and directions home. Thousands of people came and we put lots of their money in a huge bowl. We told people if they needed some to take it and if they had more than they needed to put some in. We left the money out overnight in the convention center staff. When we were done, we gave away all the money from the event to people who were poor and hurting and needed help. This is what the early church did. They made their own economy by making themselves and the resources available to everyone. They did this because they were becoming love. Whether we want to or not, we end up memorizing what we do repeatedly. It's the way we were wired from the factory. Because this is how we were made, it's a great idea to pick actions worth repeating. People who are turning into love do this. They adopt beautiful patterns and surrounding imagery for their lives. They fill their lives with songs, practices, and habits that communicate love, acceptance, grace, generosity, whimsy, and forgiveness. People who are becoming love repeat these actions so often they don't even realize they're doing it anymore. It's just finger memory to them. They don't need anyone to clap for them. They don't need validation for things inherently right and true and beautiful. They don't need all the accolades that come with recognition. They don't feel a need to criticize people who have gotten a couple things wrong. I don't know about you, but I've gotten to the end of the day more than a few times and realized my untucked shirt was uneven at the bottom. I'm usually just one button off, but sometimes two. The fact is, some of the people who have shaped my faith the most were a couple of buttons off on theirs. They've made some big mistakes. Run towards these people, not away. There's a quiet confidence in knowing we'll all hit a couple of wrong notes here and there. The report card on our faith is how we treat one another when we do. Mary ran to the tomb a couple of days after Jesus had been buried and rose again, and she thought Jesus was the gardener. He didn't embarrass her in front of everybody and tell her all of the reasons why she was wrong. He didn't have a Bible study with her about it either. Do you know what he did? He just said her name. Mary. That's it. It was the shortest sermon ever given. We don't need to send the archers to the tower to protect baby Jesus every time somebody hits a wrong note. Read the book of Revelation. He's out of the crib. Should we have a firm grip on doctrine and know what the Bible speaks to the world? You bet. Keep this in mind, though. Loving people the way Jesus did is great theology. Memorize that. Memorize grace. Make it your finger memory. Lose the stages. Your faith isn't a recital. Speak some jazz into people's lives when they've missed a couple notes. Run to them. Say their names. And if you don't know their names, don't say a thing. Because God makes people, and people make issues, but people aren't issues. They're not projects either. People are people. The next time someone near you messes up, pull them aside in private. Just give them a hug. You'll be making grace and love and acceptance finger memory for them, too. Chapter 11. Three Green Lights. We don't need as much confirmation as we think. I spend a lot of time on planes. I mean a lot. People are everywhere, and I like to be with people, so planes are just a part of my life. Last year, I flew almost 500,000 miles. They call me Mr. G at the airport. I've helped ticket agents with adoptions. I've celebrated high school graduations and mourned tremendous losses with the people who work at the airport. Sometimes I feel like Tom Hanks in the movie The Terminal. I had always wondered who in the world would shop for clothes in one of the airport stores. I'm a little embarrassed to admit to you, I'm that guy. I'm a pilot, which means I sometimes fly myself to places, too. I usually do this when the place I'm going to is close by air and I don't want to take a long drive. Once, I had just come off an intense stretch of cross-country trips. I think I flew over Kansas at least 6 times in 1 week. I'm pretty sure I saw a farmer wave to me as I passed overhead. So when I realized the next place I needed to be was a long way by car, but there was a shortcut over some mountains by flying, I decided to save myself some California traffic and take a small plane instead. I called a friend who was a member of a flying club and he got me a deal. We could rent a plane for $100 an hour. That was just a few bucks more than Hertz. Granted, it was kind of a junky plane, but hey, it flew, so I took it. I got a chart before I left for the airfield and threw together a quick flight plan. When I first started flying, I wasn't sure what a flight plan was. I figured mine was pretty simple, to get there and back without hitting anything. It turns out whenever you're going to take to the skies, the first thing you do is figure out the tallest obstacle in your flight path. This is mainly so you don't die. On the way to Palm Springs, the tallest thing was a 6,000-foot mountain, so I flew over at 8,000 feet to be safe. Just after I landed and taxied to the hangar, two guys flying an F-16 landed their fighter jet and taxied to a stop next to me. They got out wearing olive-green Top Gun suits covered with oxygen hoses, flare guns, and cool patches. The sunlight hitting the pilots created a halo effect, making them look that much cooler. Meanwhile, I got out of my airplane wearing torn jeans, an old T-shirt, and a Mickey Mouse watch. I try not to compare myself with other people, but it couldn't be avoided. I glanced back at my pitiful airplane, with duct tape hanging from the wings, parked next to their F-16, with missiles hanging from theirs. I felt so inadequate. I struck up a conversation with the fighter pilots, kind of hoping I'd get to shoot one of their flare guns. I learned they had flown 2,000 miles to Palm Springs so they could practice flying through the nearby valleys. They said flying through the valleys made them better pilots. It tested their skill and their teamwork. It sharpens their reaction time. I thought back to how I had made my flight plan. I had flown 2,000 feet over the highest mountaintops because I wanted to be safe. These pilots threw through the valleys because they wanted to get better. What I've come to learn so far about my faith is Jesus never asked anyone to play it safe. We were born to be brave. There's a difference between playing it safe and being safe. A lot of people think playing it safe and waiting for all the answers before they move forward is the opposite of dangerous. I disagree. If our life and our identity is found in Jesus, I think we can redefine safe as staying close to Him. Don't get me wrong. Playing it safe and waiting for assurances in our life isn't necessarily bad. It just isn't faith anymore. Playing it safe doesn't move us forward or help us grow. It just finds us where we are and leaves us in the same condition it found us in. God wants something different for us. His goal is never that we'll come back the same. He's hoping we'll return more dependent on Him. I'm not saying everything needs to be risky in our lives, but we'd be well served if a few more things were riskier in our faith. Loving people we don't understand or agree with is just the kind of beautiful, counterintuitive, risky stuff people who are becoming love do. Every day we get to decide if we'll take it easy and fly over the mountaintops in our relationships, or make ourselves better and find our way through the valleys. Heaven and a world full of hurting people are hoping we will. The Bible talks a lot about this. It says when our faith gets tested, we have the chance to grow. This makes sense to me. Stated differently, if we want our faith to get stronger, we need to navigate some deep places. It sounds simple on paper, but in real life, it's a lot tougher than it looks. I'm a pretty upbeat guy, and while I'm willing to go through a valley or two, I don't aim for them the way those fighter pilots did. The truth is, I only reluctantly go through difficult times or deal with difficult people. When I do, I'm quick to complain to myself about what a raw deal I got and how unfair it is for such a nice guy like me to have such hard things happen or have to deal with such difficult people. People who are becoming love understand God guides us into uncomfortable places because He knows most of us are too afraid to seek them out ourselves. It happens to me all the time, and I usually only recognize in hindsight that the hard places I've navigated help me steer a more purposeful course forward. This has been God's idea for us all along. When I finished the event in Palm Springs, it was late in the evening, around 10 o'clock. I drove back to the local airport and readied my plane for takeoff. The F-16 was gone, and I imagined those guys were going Mach 5 through a nearby valley, getting better, testing their skills, and having the time of their lives. But me, I was just ready for bed. The flight home was uneventful. I didn't do any barrel rolls or weave through any canyons, but when I got near the airport in my hometown, I went through the landing procedures and checklists. One of the last steps was pulling the lever to lower the landing gear. There are green lights on the control panel to let the pilot know each wheel is completely down, locked, and ready to hit the runway. When you see three green lights on the panel, you're ready to land. I pulled the lever and could hear the wheels rotating into position. Then something happened I wasn't counting on. I only got two green lights, one for each of the two back wheels. There was no green light for the nose gear. I wasn't tired anymore. I called the control tower, trying to play it cool. Tower, I don't think I have a nose wheel. This is the tower. Copy. Please fly by the tower. I'll try to get a visual on your landing gear. I adjusted my flight path to buzz the tower. I felt like Tom Cruise on Top Gun, except it was dark and no one could see me. When I had flown past the tower, the controller called back over the radio. This is the tower. It's too dark. I can't tell if the gear's down. Wait, what? That's it? That's all he had to say? I wanted to yell back over the radio, what do you mean you can't tell? You're the guy in the control tower. You're supposed to know stuff. After a minute or two, the controller came on the radio again and told me to fly by the tower again, so I did. Once again, he told me he couldn't tell. I was stuck with just my two green lights. Another few long minutes passed, and he crackled through the radio again. Are you declaring an emergency? Chuckling, I said, buddy, I declared an emergency in my shorts about 15 minutes ago. My mind was working furiously to figure out how I could get out of this. None of the options I could think of sounded very attractive. If I landed the plane without a nose gear, it wouldn't end well. If I stayed in the air, I'd run out of fuel and it'd probably end worse. If I didn't get to a bathroom soon, well, we all know how that would end. We've all had circumstances like this in our lives. We bank on one thing happening and it doesn't. A job, a date, a bonus, an answer, a verdict. We're all waiting for more information, more confirmation, more certainty at some point. Sometimes anything will do. We want clarity and instead we get confusion. We want answers and we just get more questions. We make terrific plans and then something unexpected comes up and they all end up on a pile in the floor like dirty laundry. Perhaps we're hoping a door would open or another one would close. Half of my friends are afraid they'll lose their jobs and the other half are afraid they'll keep them. We're hoping something we desperately need to end would or something else we want to start would begin. All the signs pointed in one direction. Then in an instant, something went wrong. The flight plan we laid out for ourselves took us high over the mountaintops, but the one we actually got flung us deep into the valleys. In short, most of us want more green lights than we have. It's easy to forget that our faith, life, and experiences are all the green lights we need. What we need to do is stop circling the field and get the plane on the ground. God doesn't allow these kinds of things to happen to mess with our heads. He uses these circumstances to shape our hearts. He knows difficulties and hardship and ambiguity are what cause us to grow because we're reminded of our absolute dependence upon Him. God's plans aren't ruined just because our plans need to change. What if we found out God's big plan for our lives is that we wouldn't spend so much of our time trying to figure out a big plan for our lives? Perhaps he just wants us to love him and love each other. Our ability to change is often blocked by our plans. Some people look for shooting stars or ladybugs landing on their noses as answers from God. Sure, he could communicate to us this way, but honestly, while these kinds of things have happened to me, they've never really felt like answers. They just felt like reminders. I don't think God uses card tricks to get our attention. Rather, he gives us hopes and dreams and desires. He gives us tenacity and resilience and courage. He makes us good at some things and horrible at other things. He brings joyful, beautiful, fun people into our lives and a few difficult ones too. Sometimes he changes the trajectory of our plans by taking away what we've comfortably known, and he lets us fly through valleys that are deeper and narrower than any we've been through before. Don't ignore the green lights you already have. What delights you? What fires your imagination? What fills you with a deep sense of meaning and purpose? What draws you closer to God? What is going to last in your life and in the lives of others? Do those things. They are your green lights. Most of us already have more lights than we need. Don't wait to join a movement. A movement is just a bunch of people making moves. Be a movement. Figure out what your next move is going to be, then make it. No one is remembered for what they only planned to do. I only got two green lights in the airplane when I wanted three. You may want 10 green lights before you do the risky thing God has for you to do, but you only have 8. I once heard a friend say, "All opportunities come with expiration dates." If you don't grasp the opportunity in front of you, it's likely going to go away at some point. Here's the deal. All those deep urgings you feel to step towards the beautiful, courageous thing you're afraid to do, you probably won't always have the chance. Now is the time. Your life, your experiences, and your faith are your green lights. Make your move. The procedure for landing a plane without nose gear is different than normal, as you might expect. You land on the back wheels first, so you know they are down and locked. Life's rules aren't much different. Figure out the couple of things you're sure about and put all of your weight on those things. I've put all of mine on Jesus because I figured out he was a light I could trust. But it doesn't end there. God has surrounded me with countless people, just like he has you. Plenty of those people are trustworthy lights who point me to Jesus through our relationships. Find those people in your life and lean on them a little. Be more vulnerable and transparent than you think you have the wheels for. Do it anyway. Sometimes when we ask God for an answer, he sends us a friend. There are plenty of questions I still have. I usually don't have all the green lights I'd like. There's probably a lot you don't have nailed down yet either. Be honest with yourself about these things. God is less concerned about people who admit their doubts than the ones who pretend they're certain. Every day I start with the things I'm certain about and try to land my weight on those things. It always starts with a loving, caring God who is tremendously interested in me and the world I live in. I'm picky about what else I add after that. I didn't know if the wheels on the plane would work, but I knew God was with me as I fretted about my landing gear. The tower had pretty much gone silent on me. It made sense. We'd said just about everything we had to say, and words can't turn into wheels. It's in those times where it feels like everything has been said that I seem to sense God's presence more clearly. I don't know what the guy in the tower was doing while I was sweating bullets and waiting either to explode or screech down the runway in a flurry of sparks and screams. I know what God was doing, though. He was with me. I finished my approach and passed the first white lines on the landing strip. It was time for me to prepare to touch down. I brought the plane down as slowly as I could, with the nose of the plane as high as possible. I closed my eyes briefly and exhaled. It was time to see what would happen. The plane floated closer to the ground, and the rear wheels touched down. As the nose of the plane came down, I found myself counting down 3, 2, 1. When I reached zero, there would either be a lot of propellers hitting a lot of concrete or a small bounce indicating the front wheel was down and locked. I was a bystander either way at this point. I reached zero in my mental countdown. There was a bounce. The front wheel was there. I started whooping and hollering and laughing. Get this. It turned out what had me all twisted was a burned-out 5-cent light bulb. I spent far too much time circling the field that night because I didn't get all the green lights I wanted. I think a lot of us do the same thing with much of our lives, too. Don't let a nickel light bulb keep you from fulfilling your purpose. God isn't surprised when we want more confirmation. He just hopes we won't get stuck waiting for it. Who wouldn't want more green lights? Yet at some point, we need to stop waiting for permission and go live our lives. God isn't stingy with his love, and he doesn't delight in seeing us uncomfortable either. Perhaps we don't get all the answers and confirmations we ask for because God loves seeing us grow. In the same breath, though, sometimes it's a good thing to pause. One of the writers in the Bible said to his friends that just because the door was open didn't mean it was for him to walk through. The difference between a prudent pause and a persistent paralysis is a distinction worth knowing. Recognize when your beautiful ambitions are getting stuck inside your head. You don't need to take all the steps, just the next one. God may not give us all the green lights we want, but I'm confident he gives us all the green lights he wants us to have at the time. Go with what you've got. If God wants you to stay put, he'll let you know. We also have some guaranteed green lights that are always on. Our noble desires, God's clear instructions in the Bible to love everybody always, his love for us, and the gift of each other. You can put a lot of weight on these and triangulate from there to figure out the rest of life's unknowns. The difference between the number of green lights we want and the number we get from God is a pretty good description of what faith is. Faith isn't knowing what we can't see. It's landing the plane anyway, rather than just circling the field. Chapter 12. Last one, best one. Jesus uses our blind spots to reveal himself to us. I regularly visit northern Iraq to check on one of the schools where our organization, Love Does, helps young children find safety in a loving environment in a war zone. If you keep up with the news, you know the Middle East is a really rough place with lots of turmoil. Northern Iraq is no different, and we do all we can to help these kids get a different vision for the future of their lives. A couple terrific organizations and a few families decided to move there and be with these kids and the people in the communities where they serve. I love seeing the kids thrive when just weeks or months earlier, they didn't know where they'd get their next meal or where they'd sleep that night. With our friends, we run schools for hundreds of kids displaced by the civil wars. We have a hospital, a school, and hundreds of Yazidi and refugee kids, and homes we've built for refugees from Assyria. We've met with Peshmerga fighters on the front lines as they battled ISIS soldiers we could see from behind sandbags a short distance away. The name Peshmerga means the people who confront death. It's an apt description of these brave men. We've given these brave Peshmerga fighters medals to let them know how proud we are of them. One time while at the front lines, one of the generals invited us to come into his tent where they had laid out a battle plan for retaking Mosul, a city of 2 million people. I couldn't wait to see the detailed maps and plans and satellite images I imagined were inside. Surprisingly, there were none of these. Instead, there was an 8-by-12-foot sandbox with some plastic army men, tanks, roads, and small white and black flags on it. I thought there would be more to it. Here's the thing. We don't need all the plans we make. Sure, plans can help from time to time, but planning to love people is different than just loving people. For some people, it's easier to make plans than to make time. If this is you, here's the fix. Make love your plan. There's less to write down that way. During one of my trips to northern Iraq, I woke up in the morning and couldn't see out of my right eye. It was weird. I kept moving my hand back and forth, covering my left eye first, then my right eye. I rubbed my eyes and shook my head a few times, but it didn't help. There wasn't anything there. I could have stared at the sun and not seen a thing. I had 5 more countries to be in before returning home, so like a dummy, I just kept going, thinking I'd sort it out later. No brains, no headache. It was a bad move. When I got home, I went to see the eye doctor. She's one of the world's best and told me I was the stupidest smart guy she'd ever met. I'm sure she was overstating it, and I was probably only tied for last. I had already decided if I'd done so much damage that I needed a fake eye, I'd want to get an assortment to pick from. I wanted one with a laser in it, like the guy in the Terminator, and also one that was a hairy eyeball for anyone who really irritated me. They've done quite a few operations on my eye since I had my problem. Before every operation, I always ask my eye doctor how much I'll be able to see afterwards. You know what? She's never told me. Instead, each time, she just says, "Bob, you're going to see more." At first, I felt like she was dodging the question. I was looking for a prognosis for my eye, but she gave me something far better. I got a promise from someone I could trust and a reminder about my life. It's the same promise God gives us every day. We want God to tell us all the details, but all we usually get is a promise we'll see more of him if we look in the right places. This doctor knows what she's doing. She practically invented eyes. Jesus knows what he's doing too, and he did invent eyes. Because I trust both of them, I'm okay with the promise I'll see more. We'll see what we spend the most time looking for. I decided a while ago I wanted a 1971 Volkswagen bus. I hadn't seen one in 20 years. A funny thing happened, and perhaps something you've experienced yourself. After I decided what I wanted, it seemed like every third vehicle I saw was a 1971 Volkswagen bus, part of seeing more involves looking for what we really want in our lives. My eyesight is slowly coming back. It will take some time to be fully restored. I'm not sure how much and for how long. I've only had a half dozen operations. I'm going for the world record. I've already seen what Jesus and the doctor said come true. Even if my eyesight isn't fully restored yet, I'm seeing more. There have been more than a couple benefits to missing sight in one eye. For instance, I know where my blind spot is. It's half. Right-hand turns at intersections are spotty. It's like playing rock, paper, scissors. I usually roll down my windows and yell, "Coming through," then hit the gas. When I read the stories in the Bible about the blind people Jesus met, I can identify with them a little more. The one I probably relate to the most is the guy who got his sight healed twice. After Jesus touched this guy the first time, he asked him what he could see. The man told Jesus, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." Jesus touched his eyes a second time, and it was only after the second touch that he could see things the way they really were. First touches, like first impressions, are great, but I think a lot of us need a second touch. There are quite a few people who have bumped into Jesus along the way, but it didn't stick the first time. It's not a failed attempt when it happens, just like Jesus didn't mess up the miracle the first time when he touched the guy's eyes. God wants us to be real with him about the effect he's had in our lives. I'll level with you. If I was the blind guy in the story, I would have been tempted to lie to Jesus after the first touch and tell him I was healed. You know, just so Jesus wouldn't look bad. But what Jesus is looking for are honest answers about what's really going on in our lives, not a bunch of spin. The reason is simple. If the guy without sight had faked it and said he could see everything just fine after the first touch, he wouldn't have been actually healed. The truth is, we don't really know why Jesus touched the man's eyes twice. I think some of the miracles God does in our lives happen in stages. Even though we've been touched by God, we still don't see people for who they are until something more happens in us. It's not trees we confuse them for. It's opinions and positions, social issues and status, titles and accomplishments, and behaviors. Having a problem with my eye has helped me understand Jesus a little better in other ways. I've been asking him to help me see and know more about the things I don't understand in my life and in the lives of other people. Most of the time, I receive an indirect answer or no answer at all. Some people explain to me early on about how not getting an answer from God really is an answer. I suppose they could be right, but honestly, I never really bought it. If I sent someone a letter and I didn't get an answer, I'd wonder if they really got it. Sometimes when we ask for an answer, God sends us a friend. They often come in blue jeans, but they could also be wearing a stethoscope and a white doctor's coat. Because I trust Jesus even more than I trust the eye doctor, I'm becoming more comfortable with the promise from God that I'm going to see more, even if it takes a couple more touches. Maybe I won't see as much as I'd like to see right now, but I'm okay with knowing I'll see more. It gives me something to look forward to. Another small but important change is I assume everyone can see more than me, and I'm usually right. Keep your eyes fixed on Jesus, or your eye if you only have one. He sees who we're becoming, and he wants us to become love. I have a friend named Lex. He has the same problem in both of his eyes I have in one of mine. After 10 failed operations, he lost his eyesight completely when he was 8 years old. In high school, Lex began to compete in track and field events. By the time he got to college, he figured out he could run like the wind. So we went out for the track team. My first thought was, how can a blind guy run track? Then I found out Lex has a friend. His friend runs in front of Lex and calls his name. Lex just runs towards a voice he knows he can trust. Everyone who runs track and field picks an event. Lex picked the long jump. This still makes my head spin. If you're not familiar with the event, you run as fast as you can down a 3-foot-wide track for 110.5 feet. With your last step, you launch into the air as high as you can from a wooden board in the track and land as far away as you can in a sand pit. Impossible for a blind guy, right? Not for Lex. You know why? He's got a friend whose voice he knows he can trust. What Lex does is both simple and impossible at the same time. When it's his turn to compete, his friend squares Lex's shoulders to the sand pit down the track, then goes to the edge of the pit and starts yelling, "Fly, fly, fly," over and over. Lex runs towards his friend's voice as fast as he can and then jumps as far as he's able. Get this, Lex went out for the U.S. Paralympic team, and he made it. He can jump farther than just about anyone in the world. Here's the reason why. People who are becoming love try impossible things because they've surrounded themselves with voices they can trust. At the World Games, Lex's friend took him to the far end of the narrow track. He squared Lex's shoulders and walked back to the edge of the sand pit. Then he started calling, "Fly, fly, fly," to Lex. Because Lex is blind, he doesn't always run in a straight line. The louder his friend called out to Lex, the more Lex wandered. When Lex hit the end of the track, he leaped into the air with everything he had. The problem? His path had wandered, and he launched crooked. Everyone in the stadium gasped. Lex missed the sand pit entirely and crashed and burned on the concrete. Lex's friend put his hands over his head in disbelief at what had just happened as he ran to his friend's side. Lex was badly bruised. His track uniform was ripped. He was helped off the field to a tent. We're all a little blind and have a tendency to wander. Sometimes we know what caused us to stop running in a straight line, and other times we don't. We crash and burn, and we usually don't know what happened. It's what happens next that will tell a lot about who we're becoming. I'm no athlete, but if I were Lex, I would have been tempted to quit. I would have thought about how unfair my life was. I'd complain to myself about how I'd jump far and hit hard. I might be afraid if it happened once, it might happen again. These are the voices of defeat each of us hears at some point. If we let them, these dissonant voices can drown out the voices we've come to trust in our lives. Lex doesn't see the world this way. His faith doesn't just inform his heart, it informs his whole life. Lex's friend got him a new uniform so he didn't moon everyone, and Lex walked back onto the field to thunderous applause. Together, they walked to the end of the narrow runway. There's a saying in track, last one, best one. His friend squared Lex's shoulders and his feet once again, walked to the edge of the sand pit, and called, "Fly, fly, fly," as he clapped faster and faster. When Lex hit the board on his 16th step, he leaped into the air like a gazelle. When he hit the sand more than 22 feet later, he won the whole competition. Sure, he'd strayed a little bit from the path before it. He'd even crashed and burned the last time he tried. But Lex doesn't let fear call the shots in his life, and we shouldn't either. We've all jumped for something we couldn't see, a relationship, a career, even our faith. We've all been beat up, too. We've jumped big and missed even bigger. We aim for the soft sand, but hit the hard stuff. Here's the thing. God doesn't like us more when we succeed or less when we fail. He delights in our attempts. He gives each of us different abilities, too. I can't jump over a street curb. Lex can leap over a Buick. I'm not trying to be Lex, and he isn't interested in being me. One thing we do have in common is having a couple good friends. These friends of ours don't need to give us a lot of instruction. They just call our names. The promise Jesus made to his friends is simply this. He promised to be a voice they could trust. All he asked his friends to do was run towards it. Jesus talked about sheep and shepherds a lot. I've had a couple dogs. I've even briefly had a parakeet and a turtle. But I could never really relate when Jesus talked about what it's like to have a lot of sheep. He said sheep can recognize the shepherd's voice because it's a voice they've come to trust. I think I understand a little more now what he was saying. God doesn't just give us himself. Sometimes he gives us a few other people in our lives whose voices we can trust. Figure out what Jesus' voice sounds like in your life. He's standing at the end of the track, calling your name. Run as fast as you can in his direction. I had Lex come to speak at a university class I teach. Hundreds of students sat spellbound as Lex spoke to them for an hour. There was a grand piano on the stage, and he laid down a song I'm still humming. It turns out this guy has some pretty strong vocal pipes, too. When class was over, we got in the car and made the 45-minute drive back to the Olympic Training Center. When I turned on my blinker to make a right turn, Lex leaned over to me and said, Bob, it's the next street. I just about swerved off the road. What? I asked in amazement. Here's the crazy part. He was right. How did you know that? I asked him, still stunned, as I made the next right. I keep track of where I am. It helps me find what I need, he said confidently. I've got a lot to learn from Lex. I have plenty of sight and use very little of it. He has none, and somehow he can see more than a dozen optometrists. I wonder if the Bible has so many stories about blind people because many of them are in touch with where they are and what they need. Oftentimes I'm not. I'm learning from Lex the power of keeping track of where I am and figuring out what I need. As we drove down the correct road, Lex asked, Do you want me to blow your mind? Buddy, it's already blown. There's nothing left, I said, shaking my head. There's a speed bump in 30 feet. A few moments later, both sets of tires bounced over the bump in the road. We've all heard the term blind faith. I didn't understand what it really meant until I met Lex. He's the wise man who told me, it's not what you look at, it's what you see. Keep running your race. Is it going to be easy? Heck no. You might even question a couple times if it's worth it. Jesus is standing at the edge of eternity calling your name. He wants you to run towards him as fast as your legs will carry you. He knows you can't always see what is before you, and he wants you to forget what lies behind you. Fly, fly, fly. His voice is one you can trust. He wants you to run big and jump far. Last one, best one. Chapter 13. 3 minutes at a time. Friendships can last a lifetime, but we make them 3 minutes at a time. Hello, Patricia? Hi, what can I do for you? Adrian's gone. Gone? Where'd he go? Let's go find him. No, Adrian died today. When I heard those words, I was stopped by a wave of confusion. How could this be? You see, Adrian had become a close friend of mine. He was particularly special to me because we built our years-long friendship just 3 minutes at a time. Let me tell you how. Adrian worked at the airport in San Diego. He stood at the front of a long line of often anxious and frustrated people waiting to get through security. Some were on their way to a vacation, and some were on business trips. Some were happy, and some were sad. It seemed weirdly incongruous. They were all heading somewhere, yet they were all going nowhere at the moment. The security lines were always too long, and I could feel the tension of 100 snagged travelers all trying to squeeze through the security bottleneck. Most mornings, the line stretched like a giant snake out the doors of the airport. None of it was Adrian's fault, of course. Not the lateness, not the bottleneck, not all the security rules, but Adrian bore the brunt of 1,000 angry stares, crumpled faces, and sharp comments every day. It wasn't because he deserved it. It was just because he was the guy at the front of the line. Adrian worked for the TSA and wore a uniform 2 sizes too big for him. His job was to check IDs to see if people were who they said they were. Sometimes people pop out in a crowd. It's not always because they're handsome or beautiful or up front or on a stage. What makes them stand out is they're not trying to get any attention at all. I'm married to one of these people. We've got 3 kids and their spouses, Ashley and John, who are these kinds of people too. It's hard to list what makes someone catch your eye in this way. It's probably a combination of many things, including humility, kindness, quiet resolve, and hard work. Adrian stood 5'0" on his tiptoes and weighed less than a bag of chips. He looked to be in his mid-60s, but it was hard to tell. He was a strange mix of youthful enthusiasm, calm wisdom, and deep love. Adrian had a sturdy presence about him that came from many years of tireless work. He walked with a swagger of a high school wrestling letterman and the humbleness of a monk. I traveled quite a bit and had passed by Adrian at the front of the airport security line a dozen times over the course of a few weeks. Each time, I noticed something special about him. No matter who he met at the front of the line, Adrian always treated them with love and respect. The people in line could have been distracted by the events in their lives, frustrated by the wait, sad at leaving, or excited about arriving. It didn't matter to Adrian. He greeted everyone with his quiet and sincere brand of love, which made things somehow much better. This person I observed from afar each week fascinated me, and I knew I wanted to meet him. Nearing the front of the line one day, I decided to thank this kind man for what he did each day, and in particular, for the way he welcomed strangers like me every morning. When I got to the front of the line, I reached out my right hand as I handed my ID to him with my left. "Hi, I'm Bob," I said. "I've passed by you a dozen times, and I just wanted to thank you for the way I've watched you treat each person in line. It's really amazing. The way you treat people reminds me a lot of the way Jesus loved people." The small man looked up slowly from my driver's license and handed it back to me as if it was his. He didn't say a word, but I could see his eyes welling up. He took a couple small steps towards me, then wrapped his arms around me and put his head on my chest. "I'm Adrian," he said into my sweater. I'll admit, it was a little more than awkward. But there we stood, just the two of us, slow dancing in front of the TSA line while 150 business travelers who were late for their flights watched. This was the beginning of my friendship with Adrian, 3 minutes at a time. We said our goodbyes, and I was already looking forward to my next trip to the airport and the next chance to learn a little bit more about him. A few days later, I got my chance. During our next 3 minutes together, I found out about Adrian's wife of over 40 years, Patricia. He spoke about her with a hushed reverence, the kind reserved for the Pope. She was obviously the love of his life. We hadn't finished talking about Patricia, but the line moved, so I did too. I knew we would pick up our conversation where we left off the next time I got to the airport. On subsequent trips, I found out about Adrian's son, a daughter, a grandchild, a brother, and a previous career he had with Aeromexico as an electrician. We began meeting at my house to talk about life and love and Jesus. Our family started spending Christmases together. It was terrific. One year, Adrian gave me a double-matted photograph of the main library in Mexico City and told me that all the books in there couldn't contain what he'd been learning about God in the past few months. I learned Adrian was saving up money for a down payment on a small house. He told me how he spent the weekend swirling a sign over his head on a downtown corner advertising apartments for rent to earn the extra bucks he'd need to swing the payment. I teased him about what might happen on a windy day when all 100 pounds of him were blown across the street and into a field. Adrian had a car in the lot at the airport, and he would drive people from the San Diego airport over the border to Mexico to catch flights. He didn't charge them. He did it just because he could, and they needed some help. People like Adrian, who are becoming love, don't keep track of all the good they do. They just do the things they can and find their rewards in giving love away freely. During one of our 3-minute meetings, Adrian updated me on his dream house. He'd saved up enough money and thought he'd found the perfect one. It would be modest by most standards, but the way Adrian described it, it was as grand as any castle in England. No doubt with a moat, a couple drawbridges, and horsemen. Yes, lots of horsemen. Patricia was traveling up from Mexico City, where she had been staying with her grown children, to see the house for the first time. He had warned her in advance the house was tiny, but he couldn't wait for her to see it. There was a twinkle in his eye when he spoke. No mansion could have a prouder owner. As the line moved, we shouted over other people's heads to stretch our 3 minutes into 4 or 5. Adrian had to jump as he shouted out the last details over the heads of 2 bald guys. He was bursting with pride. "I'm getting the house! I'm getting the house!" he shouted, with his arms waving over his head. I waved my arms over my head, too. Someone in the line cheered for him. The person standing in line in front of him